We're going to continue with open lines here on Coast to Coast. Those of you on hold, just hang there. Those of you calling, we'll do the best we can to get to you. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let's go right back to the calls. Let's start by going to Antonio in Idaho, west of the Rockies. Antonio, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. How are you?
Okay. Hope you are, too.
Yeah, amen. It's always a blessing when I get through.
It is. Some people try for years. You're lucky.
Yes. Yes, I am. This is already like my third or fourth time.
Perfect.
I am lucky. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Yep, pretty good.
Oh yeah, okay. I wanted to share about a scary movie. The scariest movie I've ever seen was The Exorcist.
It was a scary movie, especially when she turned her head. Remember that?
Oh, no. Yes, yes. Even to this day, I try to watch it, and I can't.
Really?
Yes. Yes, it's like forbidden. I don't know why. It's very scary.
What's the part that scares you the most?
That and then the body levitating and then speaking in tongues, and it's just horrible.
And the green vomit. And, remember she threw up?
Oh, my Lord, yes. And then, yeah. But my experience was back in like 1984, 85, my older brother, God bless him, he took me to the movies, and he must have parked on the wrong place. Because his car got towed. But it was a double feature night, and we watched The Terminator and then a movie called Chud, C-H-U-D, about, like, some zombies that used to come out of the sewers.
Oh, gosh. Remember that Stephen King movie, It, the clown who lived down there?
Yeah, that's horrible, yes. But I was holding on to my brother for dear life because it was already, like, midnight, and we had to walk back home. And I kept, like, staring at the sewers or the manholes with steam coming out. I watched that movie.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, but I'll pray for your daughter as well, George. Prayer does work. I am a firm believer.
There's no doubt about that. Thanks, Antonio. I appreciate that. Yeah, just before airtime, she sent me a text, said, Dad, I'm in the hospital. And she had some issues with the massive headaches, and they gave her a CT scan, and then they were going to give her a spinal tap. And there's, you know, they want to make sure she's not bleeding on the brain, but she said she seems to be doing okay, so they sent her home. So that's good. But they wanted to follow up with a doctor, but thanks for your prayers. Let's go to Michelle in Milwaukee. Take it away. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, George. I'm calling because I have recently been paying attention to the news here in Wisconsin, and it sounds like there's been, I guess, 95% to 100% of all of the nursing homes in Wisconsin have had a voter turnout that is very irregular. It's not likely that all of these people, and they've had interviews with several of the people. Michael Gableman is a retired Supreme Court judge in Wisconsin, and he's the one that brought forth the information, but the mainstream media is not covering it. Our local newspaper in Milwaukee, I live in Milwaukee, and the local newspaper kind of discounted the whole entire story, and I'm very concerned because this information, it's the recent election. We had a February primary, and there are people that are not even, they're not sentient. They are considered to be, I guess, the senile or have Alzheimer's. They are showing up as voters in the state of Wisconsin, and it's very concerning.
And you're saying that somebody's voting for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We had in 2020, there were, they called them, I guess, vote boxes. There were boxes all over the state where people could drop off, election forms that were not valid. I guess, they had like vote in the park in Madison, Wisconsin, and then they had voting boxes where I think people dropped off way too many way too many.
What is your state doing about this, Michelle?
Well, some of the, I think the Republicans in the state are not pushing for a decertification of the election, but there's a big push.
And what election are you talking about?
I'm talking about 2020 and the most recent February primary.
2020 is long gone. That's not going to happen, believe me. But, you know, there has been voter fraud since the beginning of elections. The one that happened in 2020 was nothing compared to the things we've had before and did not alter the election. And that's my opinion. Anyways, Tom, texts or tweets, what do you got back there?
In from Clinton in Louisiana. I like this one. Tell me about a time you made a mistake and how you fixed it.
I've always made mistakes. and I still make mistakes, but I want to learn by them, and that's the most important thing. There's nothing wrong with making a mistake as long as you learn by it and it teaches you something.
But can you think like of a specific one?
I've done stupid things in my life. No sense getting into it, but I've done things that I know I shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
And you know it. Sometimes you know going in, don't do it. Don't do it.
And you do.
But you still do it. And then you get burned.
Yep. But I agree. As long as you learn something, I think it's good.
Yep. All right. Thanks. Back to whose turn is it? It is Roger in Shingletown. Whoop, he just hung up. Roger, I was just going to go to you. Let's try Pablo in Chicago. Hey, Pablo, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. This is Pablo. I'm in Chicago. I'm an old veteran in the late 50s.
Thank you, sir, for serving. What branch were you in?
Air Force, top secret clearance, communications against the Russians. I have two questions and a quick theory, sort of a food for thought question. The first point is, do you remember the movie I saw it when I was a little boy, scared the bejesus out of me, called The Thing?
Oh, I sure did.
That was a winner. Secondly, a couple of weeks ago, you had a guest on. I forgot if it was Eon or one of Rick, but they talked about these children with dark or black eyes.
Oh, that was David.
Get into your house.
David Weatherly. That was us.
And they let it go because they didn't go any further. I wondered, did anybody let the kids in?
Some people have done that. David Weatherly is the person who has done the story on black-eyed children. And whatever happens, don't let them in. Don't let them in.
Did anybody ever let them in?
So I think some people have. Nothing really horrible has happened to them in terms of dangerous, but they're mischief makers. Nobody knows where they come from.
Quick food for thought. You remember the story about Faust and Mephistopheles and then the crossroads about the magicians that sell out or, you know, make a pact with the devil. I think about these politicians, one in particular. He does all kinds of mischief all his life and gets away with it and still enjoys fame and fortune, real fortune, and big support base. Do you think that stuff still exists, like people can make a pact with the devil and enjoy fame and fortune and always get away with their mischief?
Some people have the ability to cut a deal with the devil. Remember the story of Dr. Faustus. But the problem is you're going to end up paying him back with your soul or with something, and it's not worth it. All the money in the world, all the riches and famous stuff in the world is not worth it if you lose it in the end. But I think absolutely people can and probably still are cutting those deals. Let's go to New York. Will's with us. Good morning, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, George. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I hate to say it, but I can think of a couple mistakes you made, but I don't want you to cut me off, so I'm not going to list them for you.
But I've made them. I've made them. I'm human.
But overall, you know what? Any mistakes that you might make, it's so outweighed by the good stuff you do for us. Just the people you have on the show and just what you do for us listeners. And so seriously, even if I think occasionally that there might be a mistake, it doesn't compare to all the good stuff. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Very kind.
No, I mean it. And so A couple of things real quick. I was thinking last night when that lady was talking to you, the lady who was talking to you late in the show about the different sources for the book that the author was talking about. She was talking about third sources, and she would, you remember what she was saying, that it wasn't, that some of the information wasn't a first person source. Do you know
right,
what I'm saying?
Right, the caller lady. Yeah.
Right. And I was listening to her and I was kind of getting her point, which is that, you know, sometimes
she basically was saying it was hearsay that the guy was reacting to.
Exactly. And I think that it's great when it's possible to be able to talk about, to distinguish when someone has a first-person source, so meaning that I saw this or I had this conversation with this person, whether it's for the book or, you know. So I'm going to give you a first-person source from me that I wanted to mention to you, which is for Christopher Forbes, whose family is, you know, the Forbes publishers.
Okay.
Forbes magazine. I he's an old friend of mine, and recently I asked him a question about Newsmax, because you were quoting Forbes, because you said Forbes calls Newsmax a powerhouse or a news powerhouse.
Right.
So I asked Kip or Christopher Forbes, right? I said, do you know, I asked him if he knew the context of that. And he said, well, yeah, that Newsmax was really sharp, and they got a lot of Fox's viewers in the wake of the January 6th, the January 6th...
insurrection.
Protest. Yes, the insurrection, which is what it was. And because Fox was going, was blaming Trump and, being not as, you know, they were... having a certain stance, and a lot of Fox's viewers didn't like that, so they went over to Newsmax. So Kip Forbes said that he thinks the context was that Newsmax was, you know, sharp and made a powerhouse move of giving the viewers what they wanted. And so I just wanted to mention that, because I kind of have the feeling that sometimes the sourcing for Newsmax is not what it should be, and I think it is a little more tilted than regular news, like you might get on PBS, like the PBS.
Well, let me tell you, it's an up and coming television news network that has done an outstanding job in growth. It's been happening for a long time, but I'll tell you a quick short story. Back in 1997. The website, Newsmax.com, first started. I'm back in St. Louis doing my local Nighthawk show. I get a call from a guy who says, hey, you know, would you put me on? I've got this new website, because he wasn't getting a lot of interviews around the country. And I looked at it and said, you know, this is a little like the Drudge Report. This is not bad. And the guy's name was Christopher Ruddy, the founder of Newsmax. And he's the one who created the cable network as well. And they've done outstanding work growing without the capital, without the company behind them, like you have at Fox and all CNN and all the other places. So they've done it. So you're very perceptive in that. And Forbes magazine did indeed say that they're a powerhouse because they were up and coming. But they don't have as many reporters as CNN or Fox, but they're coming along. They're coming along. Let's take another quick call. Kathleen in Oakdale, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I'm wondering, have you ever heard of anything like paranormal geological survey for earthquakes in the geyser area of Sonoma County, California? Because I'm in Oakdale, which is over 100 miles to the east, by the Sierra Nevada, and Sonoma County is over on the coast, and
right,
where they have these earthquakes. But I heard it here. I didn't so much feel it here, but I heard it here. And it's not the first time.
Is it like a slow hum?
No, it's like a thunder. You almost think that is that a thunder, but it sounds too creaky-like. But it's as pervasive as a really loud thunder and ominous as when it's a long, slow thunder that's rumbling. But it makes more of a creaking sound, so you keep listening for it to be something else, and or maybe like a big motor or something. But it's too loud to be a big motor, and so I've always heard that about these this connection that this area has to, which is over 100 miles to the east in the Sierra Nevada, to what's called North Bay. And so I'm just wondering, is there apparent, I know the geologists don't recognize when we hear the earthquake here in Oakdale, they don't recognize that as a geological phenomena. That's just in our imaginations or something, or just a comment that a person makes that's not a geologist. So I'm wondering, is there a paranormal geologist that actually studies the paranormal geological activity?
An individual, you mean?
Yes, or a source, anybody that does that as an organization, is there any?
I've not heard of that before. There are a couple things going on. I think you're in an area where there are a lot of ley lines that are cutting and intersecting across the globe. That's interesting. But we've got Cal Ori, who's our earthquake predictor and expert. She basically took the place of the late Jim Berkland, who passed on, the geologist. And Cal has written a book about Jim as well. But she's not really a paranormalist, but she's pretty darn good about earthquakes and earthquake predictions. And she has still predicted that the big one will happen in California. So you need to be very careful about that. Let's go back to Roger in Shingletown, California. Roger, just got a few minutes, but you're back on. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just cut off. I don't know what happened, but I'm on a landline, too, but we have about a foot of snow falling out there right now, so
wow.
That might have had something to do with it.
Could be.
The reason I'm calling is I have a movie that just got done, and we worked on it for 4 years.
What's it called?
It's called Ruger the Rude Dog. And it's in a limited distribution across the Northwest right now, starting in Northern California. And I have a story about we had a meet and greet on Saturday at a theater, and it was you were talking about meet and greets and movies, so I thought I'd call.
Well, good for you.
But I have a story about this little girl who she had come to the theater earlier in the day, and then she brought her parents and her siblings later, and she didn't know we were having a meet and greet, and we had Ruger there, and he's a 184-pound Saint Bernard, and the movie's
a big dog.
Yeah, he's huge, and it's a cross between Beethoven and Mel Brooks, and it's a great movie. I'm the director and the writer.
Good for
and
you. Producer. Are you in the business?
No, I'm an indie filmmaker. I've won a few film festivals.
Well, good for you. Now, how do people watch this movie?
Well, I'd like to offer to send it to you. I'd love for you to watch it and give me an input on it. It's right now on a limited distribution with Valley 11 Cinema.
Can you email it, or you have to mail me something?
I can email it over to Tom and
okay.
Give it to you.
Yeah, do that.
And then the other thing is it's a beautiful movie. I mean, we did some then the music is done by Ian A. Hughes in England. With Ian Hughes Studios, and the music is just absolutely amazing.
All right, well, definitely get it to us if you would. We're going to come back in a moment with a special tribute to a late guest. We lost another coast-to-coast guest in archaeologist Jonathan Gray. My gosh, two subjects he knew well were ancient technology and the late Zechariah Sitchin. We talked about both in June of 2010. Here's Jonathan Gray. Jonathan, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, George. I'm very well, thank you.
I looked at the calendar when I knew you were scheduled. It's been about 3-plus years. Where have you been?
Well, I can't tell you all the places. It's been fun. It's good to be back in the land of the civilized again.
Absolutely. I want to talk with you a lot about ancient technology, but I had that Zechariah Sitchin story, so let's spend a little time this hour talking about that in your views. First of all,
Why don't you give us your overview of Zechariah and his theory, if you would?
Well, George, it's quite a long story now. In my very first book, Dead Man's Secrets, I was quoting Zechariah, and what has happened is this. Just to put the listeners in the picture, the theory is that a planet beyond Pluto called Planet Nibiru was dying. So its inhabitants, the Anunnaki, came to planet Earth and they started mining for gold, which was needed to create a shield for preserving Nibiru's dwindling atmosphere. So you all actually start feeling sorry for these Anunnaki.
Yeah.
Anyway, they found the hot sun of planet Earth pretty hard to cope with, so they created primitive workers by mixing the genes of male Anunnaki with the eggs of early female hominoids to bring about you and me, Homo sapiens. And this sudden speed-up given to our evolution explains how the Sumerian civilization began suddenly, fully developed, with no evidence of a primitive beginning. So these extraterrestrials jump-started everything. Oh, and something else. The planet Nibiru, some people call this Planet X, brings it into our solar system in its orbit every 3,600 years, and it's due to come here very soon. That's basically the theory.
And the story came about by Zechariah's work with ancient Sumerian texts, right? His interpretation?
That is what he's telling us. That's very true. Yes.
How did you... Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, George.
How did you get involved in this particular issue?
Well, I guess from my years of independent research, I knew that Mr. Sitchin had at least one thing correct. That paralleled my research, and that was the Sumerian civilization began suddenly, fully developed with no evidence of a primitive beginning. And as you know, in today's world where we are taught that early man was primitive, it's quite a rare thing to hear about high technology in the ancient world. So I felt a measure of rapport with Mr. Sitchin. And so for this reason, my customary cautious approach softened toward this gentleman, and I did enjoy reading his books. They were full of entertainment, good to read. So I suppose I let down my guard just a little bit to give the facts in the books due respect. In particular, the claimed fact that certain ancient texts existed that backed up his story. I guess that's where I came on board.
Okay, with these ancient texts, are you saying they don't exist or that he has interpreted them the wrong way?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I published him as an authority in the book Dead Men's Secrets and in another book, and I'll make it absolutely clear that what I'm about to say is not about the man, it's about the subject. I have no problem with Zechariah as a person. He's probably quite a nice guy.
Yeah, I was...
But for a number of years, I assumed that the story was, as he claimed, in the Sumerian records. Well, after all, you just don't make up things like that, do you? But then something happened. I began to receive emails from my newsletter list asking me about Planet Nibiru, the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, the 3,600-year orbit of the planet. And so I felt an obligation to dig deeper so that I could give a responsible answer. Well, I was checking carefully through the story, and an irritating anomaly cropped up. Now, assuming the story was true, such a misfit piece would make no sense. It shouldn't exist. So that bothered me. So pursuing the matter, I went a little further, and then another inconsistency came up, then another and another. Boy, it was growing. Now, if you've endorsed something and found out that you have problems with it, you still have to look at yourself in the mirror the next day, right?
Yes.
And you have to give a responsible answer to readers that put your trust in you. Okay, I was excited about the claims. I quoted Mr. Sitchin in one of my key books. I came across discrepancies as I began to investigate further, and that threw me into a real in-depth investigation in those areas.
Yeah.
Now, for example, the claim that the Anunnaki came from planet Nibiru, the 12th planet.
How do we know this is so? Well, according to our friend, it's in the Sumerian text. Problem. Search and search and search. But no matter how hard I might search, it was absolutely impossible to find even one such Sumerian text. Then there was Nibiru, a planet beyond Pluto. How do we know? According to our friend, the Sumerian texts tell us this. And again, I could not find one single Sumerian text that backed that up.
Did you ever contact him?
The fact that, pardon?
Did you ever contact him and say, hey, Zechariah,
yes, did,
where is this?
I was beginning to find all these problems, and so I did. I wrote to Mr. Sitchin, and I asked him if he could help me. I think I might have sent a copy of the letter to be put up on the internet if anyone wants to see it. But anyway, what I did was, there were so many pieces that didn't fit in my estimation that what could you do better than call the man himself? So I sat down and wrote to Zechariah asking him to help me. Surely he could make this clear. Well, about 2 months later, I got back a photocopy of my letter with Zechariah's few brief notes scribbled over it. Now, my first question was this. I said, Zechariah, I notice you translate Nephilim as people of the fiery rockets and also those who came down from heaven. Would you kindly explain how this is arrived at using the rules of Hebrew morphology, and where do you get the understanding that this has to do with fire or rockets? In which ancient text does this come from? The reply was this. People of fiery rockets is the Din and the Gur and the Anunnaki, those who came down from heaven. That's all he said. What ancient text, however? Then I'd also asked, what Sumerian text says that Anunnaki came from the planet Nibiru? The answer was, Jonathan, haven't you read my books? Well, yes, I had, but there was nothing in there. Where's the ancient text that says these things? My question number three was, why do many of your important word meanings or translations of Sumerian words differ so much from the Sumerian cuneiform bilingual dictionaries? Well, he sounded surprised that I was asking these questions, but the dear man had thrown down the challenge, so I had to go on my own. I couldn't expect any further help, so I went digging again. Now, I consider this to be important for a couple of reasons, George. Millions of well-meaning people had taken this theory on board.
Sure, including me, Jonathan.
Even whole worldview is based upon this for millions of people, I suppose. And secondly, I was responsible for having quoted this dear man as a source, and I had cited Sitchin as a knowledgeable authority concerning the Sumerians. I guess there were two things at stake. First of all, Mr. Sitchin's space visitors theory stands or falls on the Sumerian texts, whether they exist or not.
Right.
And that now affects millions of people. And secondly, the integrity of the ancient cuneiform tablets is now at stake because it disagrees with Mr. Sitchin's definitions. So if he's right, then the bilingual Sumerian dictionaries compiled by the Mesopotamian scribes are wrong.
Well, as you know, Jonathan, that Michael Heiser also would agree with you.
Oh, yes. Well, I guess the challenge is to produce the texts that I say don't exist, and secondly, produce verification of the translations by other experts. Because, you know, the interesting thing is that the Sumerian dictionaries exist, and perhaps it was not known that such dictionaries were in existence. Certainly they were not available on the internet or anywhere until recently, and perhaps it was thought that they'd never be available, but here we are. We've got these dictionaries, and they don't agree at all. They agree among themselves, but not with Mr. Sitchin's theory.
Has anyone else, Jonathan, tried to interpret these Sumerian texts you know, Zechariah apparently is an expert in being able to decipher them. Has anybody else been able to look at them?
Yes, actually. The University of Chicago's Oriental Institute has put out the lexical lists from the Sumerians themselves. A scholar called Benno Landsberger actually started this off. He's a great Sumerian scholar. And in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies produced by the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute, these are now available to us. Also, what we have is the University of California at Berkeley. They've put up on a website now digital corpus of cuneiform literature, and you just click on the cuneiform tablet and it'll take you to the explanation of all the words. And also the University of Pennsylvania have a Sumerian dictionary. Now, all of these lexicons and dictionaries agree with each other because they are actually written by the Sumerian scribes themselves 4,000 years ago.
But you are not saying, Jonathan, that something unusual has not happened on this planet. We'll get into that as we discuss this with you, especially some of this high technology. You just don't agree specifically that we were visited, that there was a planet out there like that. Am I correct?
What I'm correct is saying that there's no Sumerian text that backs up the theory. It came out of our dear friend's head. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Now, let's move on just a little bit into this ancient technology, this lost technology. Tell me what you think was lost, and when did this happen?
Well, I guess a whole lot of things were lost, George. What we have is an advanced technology in the past that was worldwide. I happened to be writing a history book a few years ago, and I was following the traditional line that we were all, of course, taught at school, and I wanted to bring out new facts to enlighten that. But I started digging a little bit deeper, and I came across things that surprised me. For example, we were taught that man was very, very primitive in the past, and that Stone Age man couldn't put anything together except perhaps a club and his wife's hair to pull her along, you know what I mean? But it became very evident that as far back as archaeology goes, man was very sophisticated, and that the nation of Egypt, as well as Sumeria and the Indus Valley, all popped up, as it were, out of nowhere, fully formed, fully developed, at the top, not at the bottom. And that rather than increasing in technology, they were actually decreasing as time went on, because the lowest levels of discovery, the lowest or oldest levels of excavation, show that the first substance for Egypt and those other countries was actually sophisticated more than those that followed it.
So we
started at the top.
We regressed, didn't we?
We regressed. That's right. We devolved. We regressed.
How is our civilization as a whole on this planet, is it much older than we thought?
No, it's not actually. As far back as archaeology goes, we come into the third millennium BC. As far as evidence goes, anything beyond that is hypothetical or, shall I say, speculative.
Okay. If this technology was so advanced and then we kind of regressed, how did it get so high from the get-go?
Well, the fact that Egypt and Sumeria and the Indus Valley and the Maya all sprang up suddenly, round about the same time, did get me wondering, actually. So I went researching and found that they had so many things in common that led back in a pattern to the Middle East.
For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.